Hey, the Shilling Show continues here. It's a Tuesday edition of the program as we march headlong into a new year. There are big changes on the horizon, particularly for tax law. Now, they may not be the sort of changes that are going to be beneficial to you, or maybe they will be, maybe not as far-reaching as they should be, but it looks like something's going to happen. David Murata joins us, president of Murata Wealth Management, and today's topic is understanding the upcoming Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. David, welcome back to the Shilling Show, and Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So, first of all, I'm always wondering about this, and maybe have some insights for us about the process, because we see in every major bill, whether it's a tax bill or Obamacare or anything else, these little things that get stuck in there that are so extraneous. So maybe you could help us, first of all, to set the table here and understand what the process is like and how these little stupid things sometimes find their way into these bills.
Well, the tax code is the largest and most lucrative strategy game in the world. And because we have a congressional system that every congressman's special interests help support their reelection campaign, and probably about 60% of the job of being a politician is to get reelected. That is, that's their incentive. There's this great incentive to make sure that your constituents like what you're doing. And your constituents can always be defined as some subset of the electorate, because not everyone voted for you. And so you look for who supports you and who doesn't support you. And then you try to get stuff in for your supporters, because that means that they'll reelect you, because you're fighting for them. And in fighting for them, you're fighting against everyone else. And so maybe your constituents are a lot of college students, so you try to get college student goodies in, or maybe they're school teachers and you try to get school teacher goodies in, or vets, or nurses, or big business, or any other of a thousand different constituents. Maybe your constituents, maybe you're in a state like Florida or Texas, and what's grown in Florida and Texas, a lot of our citrus plants are grown in Florida and Texas. So, for example, this particular tax bill has provisions for citrus plants that were damaged to be able to take a tax deduction for them. Now, why should it have citrus plants that were damaged tax deduction? Why not something that's more general for all farms? Well, because the senators in Florida and Texas decided we're going to stick this thing in because our constituents will like that. And the recent hurricane damaged citrus plants, and they were all complaining about damaged citrus plants. So we'll put in a damaged citrus plant farm bill. And so now Big Citrus is your constituent. And that's who you're supporting. And somehow we need to find our way as a society that putting in a provision for Big Citrus and for citrus farm plants is as repulsive as all of the other things that we find repulsive as a society. The difficulty is, although few of us are Big Citrus supporters, a lot of us think that nurses or graduate students or vets or school teachers are somehow more deserving, even though those nurses or graduate students or teachers might be married to hedge fund managers and be millionaires. So there's no provision, and there's no reason why a school teacher is more deserving than someone who's working at a fast food restaurant. The school teacher is probably making more and has better job security, and the poor person working at the fast food restaurant is probably making less. So we need to stop trying to do social engineering in the tax code and instead try to find our way to a truly more simple and straightforward and less unfair tax code that has all these provisions in it. But the tax code is literally thousands of pages, and it has provisions in it. A great number of those provisions are for less than 10 people in the United States.
You know, I'm hearing you say this, and I'm going to ask you. I don't expect that you have done this, but you haven't read all these thousands of pages, have you?
No. Most of the time when you study the tax code, you study the provisions which are specific to normal individuals. But I will tell you that large corporations understand the provisions that have been put in there specifically for them, and they're able to game the system. And unfortunately, gaming the system is exactly what we do. It's difficult when you're working in the tax code every day to try to separate, but I think it's important, to try to separate how you should think about the tax code when you're tax planning, and how to think about the tax code in terms of public policy. And the two are very different, at least in my mind. I try to take advantage of every tax provision I can for my clients. It's part of my job. I try to make sure that they can pay as little tax as possible. And then I try to vote the bums out of office who are actually putting those provisions in the law.
You know, David, I think about this, and there was an exercise I did several years ago when one of my listeners, after hearing me say, give me a red pen, one of my listeners sent me a box of red pens, and I went to work on the Charlottesville and Albemarle budgets, and I spent about an hour to an hour and a half on each one, and respectively saved $13 and $17 million from each one of those budgets with a red pen. And I think about this tax bill, and I know it would be asking a lot of somebody, but maybe a think tank could do this and hire some people with red pens to go through this bill and just excise everything that is extraneous and get down to the core of things and then resubmit it for public consumption. I wish somebody would do that, because it seems like there's so much garbage in these bills.
Yeah, the difficulty is you can't just cross stuff out. You really need to scrap the entire tax code and start from scratch, because our tax code is based upon the the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. I forget which amendment. The amendment to the Constitution that allowed them to do an income tax. 17th. Thank you. Income tax is actually a very poor method of taxation. And the first thing we should do in the country is decide what we want to tax. And we've been through a number of different sort of taxations on our website, kind of working up to what would a good tax be. But the best tax would be some kind of a consumption tax, sales tax, but not just a sales tax, but a value-added tax. And let me tell you why that's the best kind of...
Why don't we hold that? We'll make everybody sit on the edge of their chairs, because I want to talk about that. And by the way, it was the 16th Amendment.
16th.
17th was the direct election of senators, which was also a total disaster for America. But a program for another day. Hey, we've got callers on the line, and the line open for you at 977-1070. And we're talking with David Murata. He's online at muratonmoney.com, where you can read a lot of his pieces, including one piece on this topic, talking about the tax bill. Stay with The Shilling Show, and David Murata will be right back. Yeah, The Shilling Show continues. It's a Tuesday edition. David Murata is our guest. Online at muratonmoney.com, we're talking about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Let's go to the phones, because Greg has been very patient. Greg, welcome to The Shilling Show. You're on with David Murata.
David, really like what you're saying, and I'd like to add something to the code. You know, I'm all for the corporate rate going down. I didn't get all y'all's conversation, because it will, you know, stimulate more jobs, and people will get better real wages out of that, in my opinion. But anytime you subsidize anything like education, or if you subsidize housing, it really is an unfair competition and makes the price go up, and somebody's got to pay for it. I mean, at some point, you know, what is it going to be, like three individuals in the whole country paying most of the taxes? And what I don't like is the fact that you take a person who just wants to work by the hour. You know, he goes and works for Ms. Jones over here, or he goes and works for Mr. whoever down the road doing various sundry services. Not, you've got occupational licenses, you've got local county licenses, and you have business tax on all your property, if you have a little computer or something or a piece of equipment. And then now Albemarle County is going to put a rain tax on people, and then you've got your insurance overhead, your Affordable Care Act. All this together means really a person cannot live on a $30,000 to $40,000 salary, which is what a lot of people make. And it doesn't work. And I would like to see the whole system washed in Washington, D.C., the whole system washed in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and on the local level. And there has to be a total aggregate where taxes and counting fees for rain and everything, which should be in the general fund, not in the separate fees, comes to no more than 25%. And I'm counting Social everything, but no more than 25% of an individual's total income. because I really feel like I'm actually going out and borrowing money to pay tax. You know, you got your quarterlies coming. You're never really living on the money you make when you're on a middle-class socioeconomic level. And I'll just get off and see what you could do. And the federal government also, on one piece of paper, double space, I can list what the federal government is supposed to spend money on. And it is not subsidized housing or health care. And I'll get off of this.
All right, Greg, thank you very much. David?
Yeah, we're going to get a little bit into sort of the best taxation, and then we'll get into what we actually have.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best taxation is to have a single tax. It's a simple tax that way. It's like a consumption tax, only it's a value-added tax. And the way it works is this. If I am a table maker, I buy wood, and I pay the tax on the wood. Then when I sell my table, I collect the tax on the value of the table I'm selling, but I get to keep the value that I paid in the wood. And so that's why it's a value-added tax. I've already paid the tax on the wood piece, and I get to keep that to reimburse me for that tax, but I do have to collect the tax on the table. And the reason why this is good is if you just have a straight consumption tax, then there's a great incentive for me as a table maker to go buy a forest and be a wood maker too, because that way I avoid the tax on the wood. This way, it doesn't push me into vertical integration to be able to have all the pieces because I get to keep the tax on the wood. And then additionally, it's self-regulating because I have a great incentive now to collect the tax on the table because I'm going to get to keep the tax that I paid on the wood if I can collect it on the table. Otherwise, there's no incentive for me to actually collect the sales tax because I just give it all to the government. But the fact that I get to keep a piece of it helps enforce regulation. Now I have an incentive to do that. If you do that and you tax just the value added in America, then you avoid all these little rinky-dink taxes of this license here and that license there. And the problem with all those little rinky-dink licenses is people say, well, it's no big deal. You know, just pay this $50 tax to the county and you pay this $100 tax over here. But then if somebody just wants to earn a few hundred dollars, all of a sudden they're paying an exorbitant amount in taxes. So all those taxes are regressive on the smallest income earners in America. And it very much punishes those who are trying to start a business, and it's a small business. Whereas if you just have a consumption tax or a value-added tax, then if I only add a little bit of value, I only pay a little bit of tax. It's a much fairer tax.
David, let's get into what's in this bill, and I want to start out with Roth recharacterizations, which we have actually talked about on this program a number of times.
We have. There is a huge – first of all, the tax code is as I mentioned, the most lucrative strategy game in America. And if you think about it, I used to play tournament chess, and if you think about it like chess, every piece moves differently. The knights get to hop over pieces. You get to move one piece a turn, unless you castle, and then you get to move two pieces a turn. And when you take a piece, you take your piece and you put it where their piece was, except for this strange rule in chess called en passant, and that is if their pawn moved two squares, you can take it as though it only moved one, moving to a blank square and taking their pawn off the board from a different square. Those are crazy rules in chess, but no one says, what's the morality of en passant and castling, and why can knights hop over things, and what are you trying to do? What kind of social engineering are you trying to do with that? Those are just rules. Well, the tax code is filled with castling, en passant, and knights hopping over things. It is the craziest set of rules, but we treat it just like a set of rules. So Roth conversions add hundreds of thousands of dollars to your after-tax net worth. If you're not doing Roth conversions on a systematic basis to keep you in the lower tax brackets, you're probably losing out on a tremendous amount of value. Having said that, we use another technique where we convert five different accounts and we wait a year and a half later and then we see which one went up the most because they allow that under the current tax code. Well, they're taking that away. It's a small provision. It might make another $50,000 every 15 years for our clients. So it's a small part of Roth conversions, but we've been using that for years. They're taking that away, which means if you've done multiple accounts, if you've been following our advice and done multiple Roth conversions with the idea that you're only going to keep one, they're taking that away in the 2018 tax year. It's not clear from the bill if that means 2017 conversions can still be recharacterized. Mm-hmm. We're playing it safe and we're recharacterizing all of our Roth conversions that we don't want to keep between now and Christmas. Thank you, Congress, for making the next 2 weeks very busy in our firm. But that's an important change, and it takes away a small piece of our Roth recharacterization strategy. But we're still masters of the tax code in Roth conversions anyway.
How about capital gain management? One of the things I've been asking all along is, you know, what's in either of these House or Senate bills regarding capital gains?
Yes, and this is in the Senate bill, but not in the House bill. Mm-hmm. That normally when you buy a bunch of different stocks, you buy Apple at this price and then you buy Apple again at a different price and then you buy Apple again at a third price. When you go to sell Apple stock, you get to decide which shares you want to sell. So generally you sell the shares that are down because you get to take a tax loss off on your taxes. Mm-hmm. And you don't sell the shares that are up the most because you'd have to pay the most capital gains tax. Same thing is true when you go to give stock away. You give away the stock that's up the most because the charity won't have to pay tax on it. This kind of capital gains tax management is one of about 18 different capital gains strategies that we use. We've got a great article on our website, 18 Ways to Avoid Paying Capital Gains. And it turns out that 70% of all capital gains is never paid on it in America. So because there are so many different ways of not selling something and not realizing the capital gains. Maybe it's your house and you get a deduction, or maybe you just die and your heirs get a step up in cost basis. At any rate, capital gains, the tax on capital gains, the tax rate ought to be zero.
Right.
Because most of it is simply inflation anyway. Mm-hmm. And capital gains tax throws a monkey wrench into the assignment of capital. I don't want to sell this because I'll have to pay capital gain tax. I've got to keep this house, keep this rental property, keep this stock, and I can't move it to where it's more efficiently invested. At any rate, the Senate bill changes from being able to pick the tax lot into forcing you into something called FIFO, first in, first out. Mm-hmm. That means the first thing I bought has to be the thing I gift in each stock. And so if you think about it, I buy some Vanguard S&P 500, and now it's appreciated. Well, if I buy more Vanguard S&P 500, then that means I won't be able to, if I need to sell some, I'll have to sell the highly appreciated stuff. So now I don't want to buy any more Vanguard. Maybe I'll buy some iShares S&P 500. Now that counts as a different security, and so now it's a different trade lot. And when I'm done with that, I'll buy some Spider S&P 500, and then I'll buy something else. And so it makes it very inefficient because I can't just buy the security I want to buy. Now I have to buy different securities in order to maintain different tax lots. It's the stupidest provision that's in the Senate bill. They're doing it because it collects a little bit more revenue, and they want to be able to collect that little bit more revenue. But the hurt to the company and to investors, investment managers like us, means you have to pick seven different things you want to buy for the S&P 500 rather than one. And now I have to figure out, if it costs more money by expense ratio than the Vanguard fund, is it worth it because it allows me to do tax lot optimization, which currently I can do under the law. All this for a provision which ought to have a tax of zero in the tax code anyway.
So we've got about a minute before the break, but I want to ask you, why has there not been a focus on capital gains? Why are there no advocates for, if not taking it to zero, which I agree with you it should be, for at least reducing it, because it has such negative consequences?
Because the tax on capital gain ought to be zero, but because currently capital gains gets added into your adjusted gross income, this is the reason why really, really rich people who have a lot of capital gains look like they're rich in the income tax code. Mm-hmm. And it looks like Warren Buffett's not paying enough in taxes. Well, if you didn't count the inflation produced by in capital gains, mm-hmm. if you didn't count that as income, Warren Buffett's income wouldn't be as much.
So it's all an illusion.
Yeah. So the income that he doesn't pay very much mm-hmm. tax on is because he's got a lot of capital gains. And the tax rate for capital gains isn't really income. And some people call this like unearned income, and they even put in pictures of like people smoking cigars with their feet up on the desk.
I'm picturing that right now.
as though they're not working very mm-hmm. hard. Yeah, that's not it at all. It's just trying to invest it in places that keeps up with inflation. And all of the added value that goes into a stock going up has already had tax paid at the corporate level. The corporation paid tax. Now there's all of this extra value. That value got reinvested back into the stock, so the stock value went up, but it's already had tax paid on it. So all the capital gains tax is a double taxation on something that's already been paid at the corporate level. Why there are no advocates for that? Because in all of Congress, we have two economists. and they're all politicians.
Well, we do have a lot of lawyers. Maybe that'll make up for it.
Yep.
All right, let's go to the break. Final segment with David Morata on the other side. We're talking about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Stay with us. The Shilling Show heading into our final segment with David Morata. I want to quickly go into SALT, state and local tax deduction. We've had a lot of discussions on this program over that deduction. What are your thoughts?
So there's two things that you need to know about SALT, the state and local tax deduction. The first is this is just your personal planning. If you can prepay your state taxes in December rather than waiting to make the estimated tax payment in January, you can deduct it. And if you wait till the January, which is it's due by January 15th, if you pay it in January 15th, you get no deduction. Mm. So it's very important if you're doing estimated taxes to go ahead and pay your state tax bill ahead of time before the end of the year. Now, having said that, the reason why state and local tax deduction has been in the system is, imagine for a moment that your state taxes are 50% and your federal taxes are 50%. Mm-hmm. You now will make no money because one of them should go first. And if the state taxes go first, then you pay 50% to the state. Now you only have 50% left over, and you pay 50% of the 50% or 25% to the federal government. This is this counts sort of as a subsidy to states. But the most interesting thing about this is I think that people have forgotten why we have states' rights. States' rights are always about somehow fighting the Civil War and slavery. The United States is not a union like a union like all of the European unions are. We are really a set of states that are trying to compete with one another for having the best government experiment. And you know, it's ridiculous to say, well, most other rich countries don't have this. Well, most other rich countries are not the United States. Somewhere along the way, I think Americans have lost sight of the fact that the United States is United States. They've lost sight of why it would be beneficial for the United States rather than just one nation. And even Jefferson, as he said in the Kentucky resolutions, whensoever the general government assumes undelegated powers, its acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force. We are states first, and we are the federal government second. And that's why there's always been a state and local tax deduction. The states get to take their taxes first, and then the federal government gets to take their taxes second. So there's a case to be made that eliminating the state and local tax deduction is a bad idea, because what it means is the federal government is now taking theirs first, and now states have to allow a federal tax deduction, or else we could be paying 110% of our income as our tax rates continue to go up.
I hear what you're saying on this, and what I wish was that it truly was the envisioned system of federalism, the real federalism, truly was in place. We talked earlier inadvertently about the 17th Amendment, which was the direct election of senators, which really eviscerated state representation in the federal government. And so if there was a system like it was envisioned, and I could move to a state that said, we don't have to be subject to all of these federal regulations and taxes, we're going to be a free state, we welcome productive people here, we will have a minimal safety net, I would drop everything in 2 seconds and go there. We don't have that option right now.
Yeah, the best option for raising the federal revenue that we need is to take the federal revenue and divide by the number of congressmen and assign it back to the states and say, pay. Because now you'd have a true taxation experiment. Mm-hmm. Some states would go to a flat tax. Some mm-hmm. states would go to a value-added tax. Some states would go to a progressive tax. And now you'd be able to move to the state that has the taxing system you like. And every state would have its representation according to population divided to it. And they'd have to figure out how to come up with a revenue. That would be the most ideal system. Now we would really have tax competition.
Yes, and it's absolutely what we need, and we can't have it presently. In our remaining minute or so, this, David, ultimately is a big fat disappointment. I'm not saying I want it to fail, because there may be some things here that will be helpful to the economy, but really, this is a once in a generation chance to make some changes that would be significant, and they've just fallen flat on their faces.
I completely agree with you. And Rob, you know, for those of you who listen to your show, a lot of people think that you and I are cheerleaders for the Republican Party. They forget when George W. Bush was in office, we were criticizing him for increasing the deficit mm-hmm. and for increasing handouts and for all kinds of things like that. This is the reason why more people should lean libertarian and small government. To do that consistently, you have to be able to give up your special interest group, and you have to be able to have a tax code that's simple. This is not simpler, based on general principles, mindful of unintended consequences, uniform and equal, encouraging productivity, and then freeing capital and people to use it as their money as they see fit. And no special interests for constituents. That's the tax code we need. That's a much more libertarian and simple system. Republicans who are listening to this need to say, I'm willing to give all that up for a simple system. Democrats who are listening to this need to say, I'm willing to give up my special interests for a more simple system. And then once you've raised the revenue that you need to raise, just write checks to people. Don't try to give people goodies in the tax system. No one would be in favor of writing checks to people who own really big houses and have really big mortgages, yet that's one of the few deductions that's actually staying in the system.
David Morata is online at moradaonmoney.com. Thank you so much. Terrific insight, and we just scratched the surface.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right. We'll be back on the other side. The Shilling Show continues.